This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. At 3 years old, Mia Ives Rubley was adopted from South Korea and brought to live in the United States. Mia has osteogenesis imperfecta, or brittle bone disease. Her parents loved her and believed in her, but they also worried. And from a young age, she pushed back against those worries and continuously challenged her own physical limitations. That energy and drive came to a head when she found competitive sports. She competed at an international level in wheelchair track fencing and adaptive CrossFit. Athletics gave her confidence and also a stronger sense of identity as a disabled woman. Today, we revisit our conversation with Mia. When we spoke with her, she was building a career in disability advocacy and fighting to make spaces more accessible for people with disabilities. She founded the Women's March Disabilities Caucus and worked as an independent consultant who partners with organizations to change their thinking about accessibility. I started the conversation asking her what she knew about her birthplace of Busan, South Korea.
It's been interesting because I got two different stories, and one story changed when I got older and searched for my records. But originally I'd heard that I'd been dropped off at some corner in Busan and police had found me and taken me to an orphanage. I found out later that wasn't true, that I did have two birth parents who had relinquished rights. They used an intermediary, my paternal aunt, and she had signed away rights. And then I spent about a year and a half at the orphanage in Busan. And then they found out that I had some medical issues that were too complicated to be treated down there. It was the 1980s. They were still sort of recovering from the Korean War. And so there's still a lot of poverty there. And so I was sent over up to Seoul and stayed at a foster home in Seoul while I got treatment there and was adopted at 3.
What are your memories? Do you have any memories?
I don't. You know, when I was young, I used to think I had just very vague memories of a foster home. But now I'm not even sure if they were real or not. My earliest memories are really in Walla Walla, Washington, where my parents adopted me to. And I remember a couple of things, the nights being very scary to me. And I think some of that had to do with the trauma of just moving from place to place and not really understanding the bearings, understanding my placement. And so I just remember wanting my mom to come and spend time with me until I went to sleep. I also remember my parents' dog named Juno, who would come in late at night and spend time with me as well.
Tell us more about your parents. What were they? What are they like?
My parents, they're wonderful people. My mom is worked as a special education or early interventionist, and she got her master's degree at the University of Miami, Florida. And my dad is a marine microbiologist who worked at UNCG when we moved to North Carolina, and he is from Buffalo, New York.
So he's got to be a great guy.
Buffalo, New York. You guys have some commonalities.
That's right.
There. Yeah. He met my mom at NC State, and they met when my mom was invited to a cookout, and she fell in love with his cooking, and that was it. You
know, because he was cooking Wardinsky's hot dogs.
I don't know what I don't remember.
But 30% of my audience knows exactly what I'm talking.
Oh, is that from Buffalo?
That's right. One of the finest hot dogs in America, Wardinsky's.
Nice.
Now, some prefer Shelangowski, but that's a long story. Let's talk about you. So now they meet and they marry and then eventually end up in Walla Walla. Not end up, but they were there when you came.
Yeah, they moved down to Miami, Florida. My dad was doing his postdoc and my mom was getting her master's degree, and then they moved to Maryland. And my dad was working with the Smithsonian for a little while. And then he went off, and then they both went to Walla Walla, Washington, where they worked. My dad was a professor over there for a little while my mom was a early intervention specialist.
So tell us more about brittle bone disease.
It's a disability that causes, it's you get it before birth. It's a genetic condition or a genetic mutation that occurs. And what happens is that a lot of your bones just become a lot more brittle. And so I broke so many bones. I can't even keep track. And it's funny, you know, I would do the most ridiculous things and not break a bone. And then I would, I don't know, sneeze or cough or something like that and break a bone. And there's some genetic, you know, or biological explanation about that. But yeah, I don't know the specific details, but it's the most ridiculous things that I would break my bones and then, climb up a bunch of stairs and be fine.
Yeah. So, but this presented some problems in Walla Walla for your parents because their family began to grow as well. Mm-hmm. Your family grew and a place like Walla Walla simply didn't provide the services.
Yeah, especially back then, it was just a very small town. The biggest things that it was known for was the state penitentiary and the sweet onions. So there wasn't a lot there. And, you know, I went to a preschool that was wonderful. But my mom knew that we would need more as we got older. And at the time, it was me and two brothers and a sister. And so my parents had been thinking about coming back to North Carolina for a long time since they moved from there. They were like, we want to get back here. And so my dad found a job at UNCG as a professor, and they took that chance and moved back.
Meanwhile, the whole time, obviously your parents are, you know, concerned. They don't want you jumping off the stairs and doing the kinds of things that can lead to this, although, mm-hmm. as you say, you can brush up against a wall. And you are constantly pushing against all of this, right?
Yeah, I just have this personality that if you tell me not to do something, I will tend to do it. And
yeah, but Mia, it's your bones.
I know. And, you know, I think when you're young, you just don't think about it. You're used to I was used to breaking bones, and it was just like another part of life. And if it meant that I got to have a lot of fun doing it, then, you know, oh well.
Well, and this preschool that you talked about that you went to, I mean, they're what you're using hot, you're making candles with hot wax, using saws. This is a pretty...
You know, it was funny. The preschool that I went to, it was a great school because We were doing the most ridiculous things, like creating candles, which was dealing with a lot of hot wax, and then also cutting wood, you know, with saws and stuff. And it was funny, years later, I participated in this weird disability organization that was supposed to be sort of like Girl Scouts, but it was for people with disabilities. And they wouldn't even let us use, you know, hot glue guns or even plastic knives. And I was 8 or 9 at the time, and I was like,
this is Mia from Walla Walla. Don't be messing with me.
Right.
So, but you did move. Eventually came to Greensboro, and you found that a challenging place.
Yeah. I think as I was, I didn't really have language for it when I was younger, even in high school, understanding.
Forgive me, but how old were you when you came to Greensboro?
I was 5 years old when we moved here, so I was going to start kindergarten and started at Peeler Elementary School. And Peeler was great because it was a magnet school. It brought kids from all over. So, you know, kids were just different, you know, and when you're a little kid, you just don't think about identity or who you fit in with. It's just a bunch of goofing around and having fun. And it was a great school because we got to explore our interests. And that's what's so great about magnet schools is that they do things a lot differently. And it wasn't until middle school and high school that I began realizing differences that I couldn't really put a finger on. And I think it was a mix of being Asian American and then also being disabled that made me feel like I didn't fit in. There weren't many other Asian Americans in my school. There were maybe one or two other Asian Americans, South Asians, that were in my classes at the time. All the rest were refugee kids. and in different classrooms than me. And so I just felt very alienated in those spaces. And it wasn't until I got into college that I could really put a finger on why I felt so alienated.
We're going to talk more about that. But in the meantime, you were also diagnosed with a processing learning disorder. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. And so I had a learning disability. And I don't know, I was probably diagnosed pretty young with it. And I had a lot of difficulty in school. I was spending hours and hours on elementary homework. And it was getting ridiculous. And I had the processing disorder, what it causes is that there will be words or ideas that I know I have in my head, but can't really equate into words. Yeah. And so that became an issue as I was taking tests and trying to answer questions. And I was lucky enough that my brain sort of reorganized itself. And in fifth grade, I was catching up on reading and I was catching up on my schoolwork. But I know there's tons of people who weren't able to do that. And so I think just a mix of good luck and hard work really helped me get to where my peers were, and then eventually get into more academically gifted class settings.
Talk more about that good luck and hard work. Mia Ives-Rubley is an athlete and founder of the Women's March Disability Caucus, also an independent consultant who partners with organizations on disability rights. We're revisiting a conversation we had with her. I asked Mia to tell us about the life-changing trip she took when she was around 12 years old to the Paralympic Games.
That was just an eye-opening experience. I would say, and it might sound cliche, but I would say it sort of lit a fire underneath me. And you know, we went. I remember it was hot. It was so hot.
This is in Atlanta.
Yeah, this is in Atlanta, yeah, okay. In the middle of summer. Mm-hmm. And my family, we packed up in this old beat-up van, and we were driving down there. And I remember my siblings were arguing with each other, and we finally got down there and realized that we had left our tickets on the kitchen table. And so my parents were frustrated, all the kids were frustrated, and my parents like dropped everybody off at the hotel and was like, you and your two brothers are allowed to go to the opening ceremony because we can't afford buying all the other tickets. And so we all got, you know, in there, and we started driving downtown. And I remember just being stunned, not only because there's this giant stadium, you know, with the torch, the bottom of the torch, right, ring. And then you see the giant Olympics rings, and you see the Paralympic symbol. And then you see all these people on the road or on the sidewalks that are in wheelchairs and limping on crutches and using prosthetics. And it's just nobody's looking at them. And it was so sort of defying to my own understanding of how people react to my disability. And so we got out and we got tickets from a scalper, and we got into the stadium. And I remember just watching these people come out in these just gorgeous uniforms, right? And they're, again, in wheelchairs and on crutches. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're being celebrated for their physical prowess. They're not being celebrated because they want, like, inspirational, you know, doodads or whatever. It's because they've hit certain benchmarks and they're representing their country. And so I just remember sitting there and watching this guy who was a double amputee that was climbing up the tower to get to light the flame the beginning of the ceremony, and just being stunned and watching these people who were double amputees that were jumping into the stadium on parachutes. And that, you know, like I was just stunned by understanding that there are things that people were telling me that disabled people were unable to do that were doing it.
It's interesting because we've already made the point, and you have made the point beautifully, that you were not
feeling terribly constrained your whole life. You're always pushing against it. So it's not as though you were felt self-limited. And yet this, you found, just put you at a whole new level.
Yeah, I think for the longest time, I saw disability as a bad thing, you know? I think people would always tell me, you know, it's going to limit you. You're not going to get here. You're not going to get here. I was told all the time that I wasn't going to live independently, that I wasn't going to go to college because of my processing learning disorder. And so, you know, being able to see people who were being championed for their physical prowess and had disabilities and weren't concerned at all about it, just it put it on a new level for me. And yeah, it was eye-opening for me.
Well, I wonder how much of that, I mean, I can sort of imagine that in that first instance when you're being told about all the limits, you know, maybe one of the fantasies is, well, I'm just going to imagine myself not limited. I'm going to sort of integrate into this world and show you that I can integrate. And now for the first time, you're saying, no, actually, I can play this game in the wheelchair.
Yeah, yeah. I think the thing is that when you are young, it's sort of like when a little kid says that they want to be an astronaut, right? Or want to be an NBA player. It's a fantasy, right? And until you get to actually see it in action, it doesn't become as substantially sort of ingrained in your beliefs and in your sort of understanding of the world. And so I remember we went to a wheelchair basketball game, and that was just a stunning, you know, stunning to see these athletes who were in wheelchairs that had these really cool, sophisticated wheelchairs that were streamlined, and they were crashing into each other and banging into each other. And I remember just hearing these, like, cracks of, like, metal on metal and just smelling this, like, sulfury, metallic burning smell that, like, still to this day, whenever I smell it, I'm like, that's wheelchair basketball.
That's just the friction of the wheelchairs.
That's the friction, yeah, yeah. And it's just like these two hand rings that are just grinding against each other. And it really just, yeah, it started something. And my parents still didn't have a clear understanding of how I could get into it. And my brother, who has post polio syndrome, he actually got into wheelchair basketball before I got to try wheelchair sports. And I got into wheelchair sports by trying wheelchair track. And until I actually got on the track and my parents saw that I could do it and I could do it well, then they sort of got with the program of, oh, okay, Mia's going to do track. Her brother's going to do basketball. This is going to be okay. And what's been interesting is, like, I attribute a lot of my success and a lot of my ability to plan and goal set from wheelchair sports, from participating in it from a young age, from middle school. And that was, like, the first time that I really got to set goals, because I really didn't think about my future, because I felt like everybody was setting my future for me. And suddenly, now I had goals. I wanted to get faster in the 100 meter. I wanted to get stronger. I wanted to be able to throw the discus longer. I wanted to be able to swim faster. And so it really opened up a whole new world of understanding that I did have a future and that it wasn't going to be constrained by what the world thought disability meant. What my disability meant.
You started with track. What other sports then? How did that evolution take place?
Yeah, so to my mom's chagrin, I did wheelchair basketball for several years until I got to college. I definitely got to bang around in wheelchairs for a bit, and that's where I gained that love of that metallic smell. And then I also, after college, I got injured and wasn't able to get into the track chair anymore. And so I was looking for the next thing to do and got involved in wheelchair fencing and did fencing actually in Durham. I got to fence with a great team down in Durham and called Mid-South Fencing. And then did fencing for a while and got to go international with it, and then did CrossFit after that.
Well, you got to go international. You're competing at that at a high level.
Yeah, yeah. I got on the wheelchair fencing USA team and got to go to the international championships.
So you talked about the fact of being involved in sports, opening up your eyes and creating for you a future and a path to the future and your ability to then plan and organize your own activities. Now you're competing at an international level with other people who have various disabilities. What's it like to be in that world communicating with those?
You know, it was stunning the first time that I got to do an adult sort of international competition because I had gone to, during when I went to the Paralympics to watch, I had gotten to go to one track event, one day of track, and got to see people like Scott Hollenbeck and Gene Driscoll competing on the track. And, you know, they are the superstars of wheelchair track. They're like the Michael Jordans of wheelchair track. And so when I started doing, they were still competing when I started doing international travel and international competing. And getting to meet them was just, you know, you're starstruck. You're like, oh my gosh, I can't believe I'm at all, you know, in the same venue as these people that I saw when I was 9 years old, you know, and it was amazing. And it helped to push me to want to go to the University of Illinois that had the track team that many of them had graduated from.
Talk more about that. You went to Urbana-Champaign, right?
Mm-hmm. So you went to University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, and I had two reasonings of going there. One was because it had a wheelchair track program, one of the very few, the others being Penn State and University of Arizona. And I'd gone there because it had a good academic, it had a good academic record for the programs, and then also I was getting a scholarship, and then also I just wanted to get out of North Carolina because, again, I struggled a lot in high school and middle school not feeling like I fit in, and I felt like going far off, going a couple of states over meant that I could push restart on my life, and it really did. It really allowed me to get out of my comfort zone and really push myself in terms of socially getting involved in a lot of different things.
You know, what's it like? You talked about getting a scholarship. Here you are right up until that moment being told you're not even going to go to college. Mm-hmm. Now you've got a scholarship. So your ideas about who you were must have been changing pretty quickly.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Things really changed in middle school. That was really when I started getting a better sense of who I was as an individual, and I think that's when a lot of kids get to understand that. And that was when I tested into academically gifted classes, and that was when I was catching up with my classmates in academics, and that was also when I started wheelchair sports. So all of that sort of culminated in that one area, and I can't attribute one thing to the other. They're all sort of interconnected.
But it does point to, I mean, I think it's the ways in which we channel, too, and sort of create these categories of gifted and learning disabled and all of these things, and then you end up on these tracks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think about the trajectory and things that happen to you along the way outside, that as you say, at one point you said your brain began to reorganize itself. And, of course, it's reorganizing as you think like an athlete, right, and plan like an athlete. You know, it's just this is a conversation in the context of disabilities. But if you think about all of us and our limitations through a process, right, of acculturation, you know, there's a lot to think about and a lot to examine here. And you wonder about the people along the way who got lost and maybe shouldn't have.
Yeah. And, you know, I've always considered myself extremely lucky. Since I was adopted, I would say I was knew that I was extremely lucky. I remember when I was little giving my parents money during Christmas time and asking them to give it to kids that weren't so lucky. And I've always considered having been adopted at all, knowing that there are kids still in foster care, knowing that there's kids still, you know, who are hungry and who never got to go to college. So having that understanding really shaped why I've decided to go the path that I have. And, you know, I think when I got into academically gifted classes, I knew I was leaving behind a lot of friends. And I think that was another tough thing, was I had a lot of friends who were in the other tracking class, the regular class, which was, you know, seen as demeaning for right. some people. And that really shaped sort of my understanding that I was extremely privileged, and I had to use that privilege to try to help in whatever I could. My parents also had us volunteering all the time. We did volunteer together as a family once a month when I was really young. And then when I got into middle school, my mom said, you either have to work, I think it was high school, you either have to work or volunteer during the summers. And so I volunteered. I volunteered at a science center and then also at a couple of other places, at nursing homes and hospitals. And yeah, that was just sort of ingrained. I think part of it, again, was that I was adopted and understood I was lucky. And then all throughout my life, I've just found that I've been super lucky in how I've gotten support.
You decided to support that and to nurture those feelings by coming to the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, for a master's in social work.
Go Tar Heels, yeah, yeah.
Tell us about your plans. I mean, again, how were you in that moment planning to apply that?
Mm-hmm. I got my degree in sociology and was learning about issues around criminal justice, how unfair the criminal justice system was. I remember I had an amazing teacher, Professor Marshall, who I went to two different classes of hers because I loved her so much. And she was talking to how the system was just so corrupted by just the systematic way of how it oppresses certain people of color and then also people who don't have any money. And, you know, I wanted to figure out how I would fit in with this unjust system and how I could help. And as a youngin, you know, mm-hmm. in undergrad, you think you can conquer the world, right? You think you have all the right answers after you've graduated from undergrad. And what I loved about going to UNC School of Social Work was that it taught me exactly the opposite, that I didn't know anything, that my clients knew everything, and that I needed to make sure that the clients made their own decisions. And that was a breakthrough for me because for the longest time, I grew up having people tell me what I need to do to be successful, you know? And, you know, PTs, OTs would tell me how I had to sit, how I had to do these exercises, blah, blah, blah. Never asking, you know, what is your goal, you know? Right. And the School of Social Work just switched that up on me. And I loved that about the training there, was that it made me give up all these pretenses of thinking that I understood the world and I was going to fix it immediately.
And then your initial caseload turned things around for you, too, because mm-hmm. it proved there were some challenges there that proved pretty
Yeah, difficult. Yeah. So I worked for the Division of Vocational Rehabilitation for 5 or 6 years. And I had a caseload of people with mental health disabilities and was trying to help them find employment. And that was when I really understood the nitty-gritty issues between policy, good policy, and real-life issues. And we would deal with issues around Medicaid, Medicare, SSI, SSDI, understanding how the mental health reforms in North Carolina at that time, which, as everybody knows now, right. were horrible, right. did awful things.
Deinstitutionalization. We're going to treat everybody in situ because it's better than a hospital, but the resources didn't follow.
Right.
So if there's no money to actually follow these people, then
right.
the hospital might have been better.
Yeah, yeah.
It wasn't
and
good.
Just like seeing all these people ending up in prisons
yeah,
and
yeah.
hospitals and, you know, understanding that and seeing how these policies were just putting Band-Aids on the systematic inaccuracies that were occurring frustrated me in the most. You know, it just was so frustrating, seeing the same clients over and over again and seeing clients who would commit suicide, and there was nothing you could do.
Because you might get these clients placed, but there was simply no infrastructure to maintain them. Even if they're a job site, people might have been willing. It's just not there because...
Yeah, and I literally feel horrible about doing this, but recommending they don't work. Because if they start working, they lose their SSI or SSDI. Right. And then they lose their Medicaid and Medicare. And then they have no insurance. And then they get sick because they're stressed out at work. And then they end up in the hospital. And then we have to apply for SSI and SSDI over again. And that was ridiculous. And it wasn't helping them get to where they wanted to go.
So what do you do next?
You know, I started changing how I reacted to certain emergency situations while I was working for vocational rehabilitation. We had been taught in social work school to always call the police when somebody was going to harm themselves or be a burden, you know, be at risk of harming others, right? And I had to stop doing that because I realized how much, especially for people of color, how much I was putting them in danger. And so I would literally put them in the car and drive them to the hospital. And I was realizing that I couldn't follow a system that I felt wasn't fixing things. And so for a couple of years, I thought, oh, well, maybe I'll try research. But for me, as an inpatient individual who wants to sort of see results sooner rather than later, I got frustrated with research. I got frustrated with sort of the hierarchy within academia, and I got tired of sending paper after paper and not hearing from, you know, medical journals about whether they wanted to produce it or not. And so that was around the time of the election, the 2016 election that brought in the current administration. And I had been thinking for a while how I could get more involved in community organizing, because I had done some throughout college and throughout the rest of my life, but I hadn't really, you know, gotten involved.
Right.
And so I remember the night after, the morning after the election results came in, just sitting there in bed, promising myself that I was going to do more. And amazingly enough, the Women's March, people from the Women's March started posting that they were going to do a march. And I was like, well, I need something to keep myself busy. And so I tried to contact some state reps who were helping organize the state sort of reaction to the Women's March, and hadn't heard anything. And, you know, I don't blame them, because you get inundated with emails and requests and stuff like that. So I hadn't heard anything, and then started seeing things pop up about disability and about accessibility at the march. And I was like, well, I remember going to numerous marches and feeling very unsafe, because people would sort of trip over you, people would ignore you, and sometimes you'd go in routes that weren't accessible. And I was like, well, you know, I know a little bit about accessibility from my own personal experiences and from working for vocational rehabilitation. So let me see if I can get in contact with the national organizers. And that's when I began, I'm very good at Facebook, and began sort of looking for who was connected to the pages that were popping up, and started contacting
the pages that were talking about disabilities and, access,
the
march?
The march.
Yeah, okay.
People who were connected to the event pages that said, we're doing a national march. And so I started contacting them and got in contact with somebody who was organizing with a national group, but they were from Pennsylvania, and they contacted me back and were like, yeah, actually it was funny, because I was in Disney World when they contacted me, and was like in like extreme heat, and just like got this call, and I was like, okay, I'll talk to you in the middle of, you know, It's a Small World or something like that, and was like talking to them as the, like, you know, music is going on, and told them that if they wanted to be as inclusive as they were saying, because they were trying to say that they were going to break, you know, records and break talk about intersectionality and stuff like that. And I was like, if you are going to say you're going to be inclusive, you need to be inclusive of disabled people because we make up 1/4 of the population. And it took a little while. It took some, you know, negotiating between us to really get them to understand my point of view. But after a while, you know, I got a bunch of people who were my friends and people I knew from wheelchair sports, and they contacted other people that they knew who were in the disability rights community spaces, and eventually got enough people together that the Women's March was like, okay, yeah, we'll make sure that this is accessible. We understand there's going to be disabled people coming to the march.
More than we'll make sure, they asked you if you could help them make sure, right?
Yeah.
To talk about your role in that.
Yeah, so I was working with them on everything from, you know, disability services to the accessibility at the march. And some of that took a lot of negotiating because limited resources, limited timing and stuff like that. And I told them that this needed to be done.
Talk about some of the examples, like, I mean, a particular first aid tents that are, you know.
Well, we had a disability accessibility tent there. Yeah. And that out of it, we had things like snacks for people who might have diabetic crashes. We had masks for people who were scent sensitive or even had, you know, health related issues. We also had blankets and hand warmers for people who had circulation issues. We weren't sure how cold it was going to be. We also had mental health peer support specialists there. So people who also had mental health disabilities who were there to help anybody else who might have an issue being in large crowds. And we had an area where people could walk to if they got overstimulated. Another huge thing that we did was a lot of places have ASL interpreting. We actually had people who were certified deaf interpreters, which meant that they were also deaf. So they were interpreting for their deaf peers. And that, I believe, was the first time a mainstream march or event had certified deaf interpreters. And I've used that every time since.
You know, I just wanted to sort of take a tangent here to talk about the Women's March, because so much was made of it, and sometimes the conflict and the inclusivity and some of the tensions. But it seems to me a hallmark of that march and the aftermath, and it's still going on because it's because the fallout has, I mean, it's still growing in some ways. But the idea that you'd have a plan, you have this very large event, resources are always short. Including new ideas, asking people to contribute once you're aware of something that you hadn't been aware of, to kind of, in the process, bring you into the planning and not say, look, we've figured this out. Thanks very much for your help. We'll talk to you next time. It seems to me one of the unmarked qualities of that march, which was that it continued to open its mind and stay open to new possibilities, which left it open to the criticism that it was, you know, sort of all over the place and not cohesive. But in fact, that's what a good planning and a good resistance will do, is constantly open itself.
Yes, I would say a good ally or co-conspirator, an individual who wants to do civil rights work, has to be open to criticism. Mm. And what I like to say is be comfortable with being uncomfortable, because you're always going to be uncomfortable in those spaces. And being allowed to be pushed and prodded and learning from that. There's a difference between making a mistake and not learning from it. If you're open and you allow yourself to learn from those mistakes and be like, I'm going to be quiet and listen to these criticisms and reflect on them and figure out how much validity there is and react in a constructive manner, that makes you a true civil rights activist. If you're not willing to listen to any criticism, then you're not doing the right work. Then you may be either burnt out and you may need to take a step back, or you're not, you haven't been doing it from the start.
Yeah. You might be actually working against the cause ultimately. Right. And that's where you see these movements begin to take strange paths that you didn't understand. And that's one of the turns that they may take. Talk about this, because at the same time, you are also beginning to develop ideas about your ethnic identity, and there's some conflicts emerging there. And in fact, at some point, you did abandon the idea of death. Talk about exploring your Asian identity.
Yeah, so I grew up in a mostly white family. I call myself transracial, which means that I look one way and grew up sort of internalizing a different culture or a different race. And for the longest time, I didn't really want to explore being Asian, partially because the first time that I did explore that was at a Korean language school and got bullied there because I was in what was termed the white class, the white people's class, because I didn't know Korean. And so that experience really turned me off. Yeah. And I grew up in a very white community, and people responded to Asians in weird ways and ways that weren't very constructive to me understanding who I was, in very negative ways, you know, very racialized ways. And so I didn't want to explore that. And then I got into college and I had this friend that I was interacting with. We were in a theater company together, and she was also Asian. And she was just goofing off with me one time, talking about what it meant to be Asian, just talking about these bad stereotypes people have, and then, you know, making fun of them and such. And that really sort of helped me open up to who I was. And then it wasn't until very recently that I started moving in Asian American, Pacific Islander political spaces and hanging out with a lot of Asian Americans and discussing issues of race and issues of identity. At the same time, I was also looking into what it meant to be an adoptee and what it meant to be a transracial adoptee. And that sort of coincided with understanding. I had a friend who was also adopted who I was talking to and saying, you know, I never feel like, I always feel like a fraud in Asian American spaces because I never feel like the adoptee experience is part of that, you know, that language or that storytelling of what it means to be Asian American. And they looked at me and they're like, no, being an adoptee, having that experience is part of the Asian American experience. And that really broke me from my usual understanding of what it meant to be an adoptee.
Well, tell us how so. And I think maybe telling us about your visit last year to the orphanage in South Korea, where you started out, may shed some light on that.
I think understanding the political sort of structural system around adoption and or transnational adoption, shall I say, helps you understand how it fits in with the Asian American experience, because transnational adoption didn't start until after the Korean War. A bunch of soldiers saw a bunch of orphans in Korea and they wanted to adopt them, and they brought them to the States, and that began the transnational adoption movement. And to understand that my story is part of the Asian story, is part of sort of this colonization, this decolonization experience, and how that relates with like the adoption industrial complex of moving kids from these poor areas into America and them losing sort of their racial identity and their cultural identity.
Well, tell us how this worked personally for you when you visited the orphanage and the Buddhist temple next door.
Yeah, so, you know, I went back about a year and a half ago, and it was the first time I went back, and it was literally 20 years since I had been to Korea, since I had left. Or sorry, 30 years.
Yeah.
It had been literally 30 years since I had been back. And I was working with this translator who was from this adoptees organization that was run by adoptees trying to reculturalize themselves to Korea. And he kept on telling me how sorry he was that his generation had failed us and that so many adoptees had been, or so many babies had been sent to America and abroad. And it was interesting because, you know, for a while I was just had these weird emotions going back, mostly good emotions. And we got to this Buddhist temple and it was inaccessible, so I was really tired. I had climbed up all these stairs, and we were sitting in this very quiet area where there were these people next to me who were praying and meditating. And he sat down next to me and was like, I'm really sorry again for what our generation had done, and that I believe that your birth parents, when they had signed away the papers, that they had come here because this is the only, like, the main Buddhist temple in Busan, and they came here and prayed for you. And at the time, I didn't really know how to process that. And, you know, I'm still sort of processing that, you know. But it really affected me in understanding sort of this sorrow and this trouble and a mix of anger and sorrow that I believe most Koreans harbor. And it's given a word, it's called Han. And throughout the generations, you'll hear Koreans talk about Han and this sorrow and this anger from being colonized by different imperial cultures. So it was a really interesting experience.
And I wish I had more time to pursue this because it's something that you say you can feel even though you were raised in this country.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a fascinating thought, and I wish I had more time. Mia Ives-Rubley is an athlete and the founding coordinator of the Women's March Disability Caucus, also an independent consultant who partners with organizations on disability rights, and you can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. Mia, what a pleasure. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Our program is produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hall of Mormon, Kaya Findlay, Stacia Brown, and Jennifer Brookland. Josie Taurus is our intern. Robin Copley engineered this program. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacia.